You're listening to Hindsight on Radio National and our special series, Torn Curtain, The Secret History of the Cold War. Some hints of the existence of Richard Nixon's secret nuclear alert were first uncovered by the veteran investigative reporter Seymour Hersh in 1983. But as we've heard, it's taken 20 years for the documentary evidence to be released. And there's a chilling subplot. At the same time as Nixon was trying to bluff the Soviets into thinking that he might go nuclear, he was drawing up contingency plans to drop the bomb on North Vietnam.
Roger Morris, who was a deputy to another deputy to Kissinger, told me late in the game now, in 1974, just after Nixon had resigned, it so happens, that Nixon had in fact made nuclear threats and prepared target folders for actual nuclear targets. And when I asked him about it, Roger told me in 74 that he had personally seen the target folders for the airplanes to deliver these weapons, including the prospective targets and an estimate of how many would be killed in the course of dropping high-altitude, low-yield nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, which would cause virtually no fallout. The fireball wouldn't touch the ground, and would destroy a transshipment point on a rail line from China. One of these targets then was a mile and a half from the Chinese border, and this was to send a very strong signal to China as well as North Vietnam that we were prepared to go all the way here, though this initial strike was supposedly not going to kill very many people in the jungle. Now, he saw those plans in September and October. And what happened was then in October was the moratorium, October 15th of 1969, which brought 2 million people in the streets in demonstrations in a variety of cities all over America at the same time. So they added up all the people and it became one vast, large demonstration, bigger than perhaps any country had ever had up till that point. And as Nixon himself says in his memoirs, it was that point that he realized that what he calls his November ultimatum would fail because the North Vietnamese would see there was so much opposition to any escalation of the war that they wouldn't expect him either to carry out the threat, or if he did, they wouldn't expect him to be able to repeat it. And to be effective then, he'd have to repeat it several times, and that would cause immense escalation of the anti-war movement.
This is Dennis Smithson in Lower Sproul Plaza, where there are many thousands of people gathered to hear this particular rally. They tried to hold it inside Pauley Ballroom. There just wasn't enough room. ASUC President Dan Siegel is moderating, and he's currently at the microphone. So we'll go to the podium now, and ASUC President Dan Siegel.
The Berkeley chapter of the Student Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam stands unequivocally opposed to the warning, demotion, dismissal, or suspension of any university employee from participation.
There's too many
Vietnam War crimes.
We want to have peace, and the only way that we can have peace is to bring the boys home from
there's
Vietnam.
Far too many of you die.
The person who is most American in America is that person who exercises his right to dissent. We oppose the war, understand that.
Father, Father, we don't need to escalate.
One of the things that I want to talk to you about right now
is a
thing called the credibility gap.
For all in
everything that the government's been saying about the war in Vietnam.
Pick up the racist wall in Vietnam when we don't have justice in the United States.
Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Marvin Gaye with What's Going On. Like many black American musicians in the late 1960s, Gaye was inspired and radicalized by the anti-war protests sweeping across the country. and by the stories of black GIs returning from Vietnam. But gay and the anti-war protesters weren't the only ones wondering what was going on in the autumn of 1969. In the Kremlin, Soviet leaders were deeply perplexed by Nixon's nuclear bluff.
In the end, the Russians ignored the operation completely. Anatoly Dobrynin, the Russian ambassador to the United States, met with Henry Kissinger and met with Richard Nixon, and Nixon was all briefed, prepared to say that we have military actions going around the world, you should know that anything can happen, the minute Dobrynin mentioned this, but Dobrynin never did. My speculation, although we don't know this for a fact, is that the Russians, noticing what we were doing, were puzzled, but did not think that we were really going to use nuclear weapons. That is, our bluff was pretty obvious to them. And what this operation did in the end was the worst of both worlds. And that a president or a secretary of state or a national security advisor who believes that you can treat nuclear weapons as if they're swords that you can wave easily and fool other people into thinking that you're about to use them without creating risks that they might actually be used is being foolhardy. Nixon called this the madman nuclear alert and called his theory the madman theory. But I think as we look back on this, we should see that perhaps there was an element of madness in the strategy that we pursued here.
Professor Scott Sagan. Well, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger miscalculated the effect that their nuclear saber-rattling would have on the Soviets. But it's also become clear that their strategy was based on a misreading of Moscow's relationship with Hanoi and of Soviet attitudes to the war in Vietnam.
The Soviet Union saw Vietnam partly as a problem that had to be contained, controlled, managed, if you like, so that the Soviet Union would not come into direct confrontation with the United States. So I think that sort of undermines the theories of some in the West subsequently, and perhaps at the time, that the Soviet Union was using Vietnam to tie the United States down in Southeast Asia. I don't believe that was true.
Stephen Morris. He was the first Western researcher to be allowed into the former Soviet archives on the Vietnam War. What Morris found there persuaded him that as far back as the 1950s, the Soviets had been extremely reluctant to become involved militarily in Vietnam. And this reluctance was sharpened by the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962.
I think that the Cuban Missile Crisis was important, and I think that because of that, the Soviets felt that their clients could potentially drag them into something that they didn't want to be involved in. And I think that at that time, Khrushchev and those around him and the Soviet leadership felt that the Vietnamese were like the Cubans in that they were too adventurous. And that is a continuing theme, which is, I find, quite striking, a continuing theme in Soviet internal documents about Vietnam, that the Vietnamese had an overly optimistic view of their own prospects, and had underestimated the resolve of the United States.
And indeed, the Soviets didn't actually want the North Vietnamese to pursue a military victory.
No, I don't believe they did. I think that they felt, and this would have been consistent with Soviet doctrine globally, that it was better to use limited amounts of military force to achieve a political and diplomatic outcome which would serve the interests of the Soviet Union and its friends.
For the Soviets, U.S. direct involvement in the conflict in Indochina changed the whole situation. Now, for the Soviets, it was an issue of prestige, and during the Vietnam War to support Hanoi in the war against the United States.
Ilya Gajduk. In Gajduk's view, it's the growth of American military involvement in Vietnam in the mid-60s which spurs the Soviets on to overcome their caution and get involved themselves, which they do, providing arms, money and military training to the North Vietnamese. For both the US and the Soviets, it was their credibility which was on the line.
First, you know, a communist country, a communist ally, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam found itself under direct attack of, as the Soviets put it at the time, American imperialism. And in order to prove themselves as a reliable ally for other communist countries, especially in Europe, in order to withstand criticism on the part of Beijing, the Soviets could not but to undertake more active steps in supporting the Vietnamese communists. And so the Soviets had to play more active role, but at the same time, this Soviet role and the Soviet growing involvement in the Vietnam War changed the whole situation in the triangular relations between the Soviet Union, Communist China, and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam.
I mean, wouldn't it have been open to the Soviets, though, to say to the North Vietnamese, well, unless you're prepared to adopt a more tractable position in the negotiations, unless you're prepared to go some of the way towards achieving a negotiated settlement, we will withdraw some of our military support in terms of arms, or the provision of arms, or indeed the financial aid they were giving to the North Vietnamese. I mean, they did have some levers that they could have used, didn't they?
Well, but of course they could... Could say the Vietnamese that they, if the Vietnamese did not act in the way the Soviets would like to see them to act, they would Moscow would withdraw their support. But this would push the Vietnamese closer to Beijing.
From the Soviet point of view, communist revolution, Maoist style, should not be allowed to prevail in Vietnam because it would inspire the victories of communist Maoist style pro-Chinese communist parties in other countries of Southeast Asia. There was a realignment of the communist world such that both the Chinese and the Soviets came to regard the United States as lesser enemies than the other. And therefore, the tension between and the conflict between the Soviet Union and China became more important to each of them than their conflict with the United States.
So your argument in relation to the Soviet involvement in Vietnam is that one of the reasons for them becoming more closely involved in Vietnam was in fact to counter the influence of the Chinese rather than to combat US imperialism.
Exactly. Yes, I think that's definitely true. And ultimately, they would have liked to have seen a negotiated settlement of the Vietnam War. They didn't particularly care what the complexion of a negotiated settlement would look like, so long as the Vietnamese were still more beholden to them than they were to the Chinese. So, in other words, competition for influence in the communist world was the principal motivating factor for the heightened Soviet involvement in Vietnam.
One of the things that I want to talk to you about right now is a thing called a credibility gap. In case you don't know what that is, it's everything that the government's been saying about the war in Vietnam.
By November 1969, less than a year into his presidency, Richard Nixon's Vietnam strategy was in tatters. Neither nuclear threats nor diplomatic carrots had succeeded in getting the Soviets to come to the party. And at home, the anti-war movement had spread to the army.
At Fort Bragg, GIs united against the war in Vietnam at Fort Bragg, had a march of 500 GIs against the war. What those troops marched for was the immediate withdrawal of the troops from Vietnam. Why? Because they had been there. Why? Because they had seen it, and they knew that it was no good for them.
So Nixon fought back. On November the 3rd, 1969, he went on national television to give a major speech on Vietnam.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. Tonight I want to talk to you on a subject of deep concern to all Americans and to many people in all parts of the world, the war in Vietnam. I believe that one of the reasons for the deep division about Vietnam is that many Americans have lost confidence in what their government has told them about our policy. The American people cannot and should not be asked to support a policy which involves the overriding issues of war and peace unless they know the truth about that policy. Let us all understand that the question before us is not whether some Americans are for peace and some Americans are against peace. The question at issue is not whether Johnson's war becomes Nixon's war. The great question is, how can we win America's peace? And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
It was kind of a tour de force because what he said was, we are staying until Hanoi either gives up, to paraphrase him here, or the Saigon regime can hold out on his own, on its own. And to anyone who knew Vietnam, that means we're staying forever. The war is going on indefinitely. But Kissinger very successfully accompanied that with backgrounders at the same time, in which he said, don't believe that. You know, he's just saying that. He's just saying that for the right wing. You know, don't worry, we're going to be out by the end of the year or the end of next year. And that they believed because it seemed so rational and reasonable and what as it was, as it would have been if they had not been following this genuinely mad theory. We did have, in effect, a madman in charge, though he didn't realize it and others didn't realize it. And Kissinger was the obedient servant of that rather mad policy.
Daniel Ellsberg. Nixon's silent majority speech was a public relations victory. Public opinion swung back in favour of his policy on Vietnam. And over the coming months, the anti-war protests ran out of momentum, especially after the killing of four protesters by the National Guard at Kent State University in May 1970. Meanwhile, Nixon and Kissinger escalated the war, sending American troops into Cambodia and stepping up bombing. 4 million tons of high explosives and napalm rained down on the towns and villages of Indochina over the next 2 years. But the escalation failed to intimidate the North Vietnamese. In March 1972, the North Vietnamese Army launched a major offensive against the South.
They believed that in 1972 they could achieve a decisive victory over the South Vietnamese, seize large parts of South Vietnam, declare the city of Hue the capital of a new liberated zone of South Vietnam, and from that position negotiate a political settlement with the United States and South Vietnam that would put them in a box seat politically. That's what the North Vietnamese believed.
Nixon was furious at this new sign of North Vietnamese resolve. In April 72, in a conversation with Kissinger, he weighed up the options for an American response. The US could launch a new wave of bombing against civilian targets deep inside North Vietnam. Or it could go nuclear.
Will the attack on the North help in any way?
The attack on the North?
Or is it purely psychological?
Well, it's partly psychological, although it partly makes it harder for them.
You see, the attack on the North that we have in mind, the power plants, whatever is left of the docks.
Well, there's still about 50% of the POL.
The docks, and I still think we ought to take the dikes out now.
I think...
Will that drown people?
Now, that would drown about 200,000 people.
Oh, well, no. I'd rather use a nuclear bomb. Have you got that ready?
Now that, I think, would be too much. Too much.
A nuclear bomb. Does that bother you? I just want you to think big, Henry, for Christ's sake.
I think they're going to make it.
In the end, Nixon dropped the nuclear option, and went ahead with a big bombing and mining operation in the far north of North Vietnam. Meanwhile, the North Vietnamese offensive had failed to achieve the decisive victory on the ground which Hanoi had hoped for. Stephen Morris believes that new evidence from the Soviet archives shows that by autumn of 1972, the North Vietnamese leadership had abandoned hope of a military victory.
They suffered enormous casualties in the Easter Offensive. Losses were so severe, and the losses had been so severe, more than probably most analysts in the West understood. They felt that they were no longer able to conduct the war in the way that they would want to achieve primarily military victory.
So in other words, they'd become demoralised to a certain extent.
They had become emasculated and demoralised.
So are you arguing here that the Nixon-Kissinger strategy was in fact more successful than it subsequently been thought to be?
Yes, exactly. I think that had Kissinger and Nixon known how much damage they had inflicted on the other side, they may have taken a stronger position in the peace negotiations and in enforcing the peace negotiations. And in sharing that information with key elements in Congress, they may have had a more compliant Congress than they subsequently did have.
So in other words, you're saying that had that happened, that there might not have been the withdrawal of US support for the South Vietnamese regime and indeed a different outcome to the war.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Does that mean it was right?
Does that mean it was right? Well, it depends on what you think that the objectives of American foreign policy should have been in Vietnam. I believe that the maintenance of a non-communist South Vietnam was a legitimate goal, as legitimate as the maintenance of a non-communist South Korea.
What was really appropriate policy was to find some way of achieving certain aims, such as humanitarian aims in Vietnam, by means other than continuing a massive, murderous war. I believe, and here I'm agreeing with Morris to some extent, I believe that they could have achieved what they, their certain minimum goal, which they didn't achieve, of keeping Saigon in anti-communist, pro-American hands through 76. You could have prolonged the bloodshed, in other words, longer, if that is to be considered success. And from Nixon's terms, it certainly would have been success. It would have meant that he'd gotten out of office at the end of his second term without having lost South Vietnam to communism. He would have put it off to the next term.
Would that have made it right if they'd been able to achieve that objective?
No, to have killed millions of people in order to postpone the unification of Vietnam by a matter of years, a few years, not 50 years, not 40 years, not 20 years, but a few years. Was that worth millions of lives? That's a moral calculation, which to me is... I don't want to characterize it too much. I don't regard it as within my moral framework.
Daniel Ellsberg, you've been listening to Hindsight and the third episode of Torn Curtain, The Secret History of the Cold War. Technical production was by Judy Rapley, and the readings were by Justin Monjo and James Carlton.